Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and today we have a special guest, Dean Moya Andrews. Moya serves as Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculties at Indiana University, and she's also a Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences. Moya was born in Australia and received her bachelor's degree from the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Her master's degree is from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and her doctorate is from Columbia University in New York City. She was the recipient of the 1999 Distinguished Scholars Award given by the Office of Women's Affairs at Indiana University. And more recently, she received the 2001 honors from the American Speech and Hearing Association. Moya, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Christina.
Let's start off with good news. Tell us about the Hesburgh Award.
Yes, that is very good news. Our Scholarship of Teaching and Learning program at Indiana University Bloomington was recently awarded the Hesburgh Award. We were very excited about that because this is a program that has caused a lot of interest and involvement of faculty on this campus. And so it is a wonderful collaborative effort where a lot of people are involved in making this program grow and develop and be successful. And so this external recognition is especially exciting.
And this is something that you had been working on for a long time.
Yes, when I was associate dean in the office under the leadership of Debbie Freund, I began this with a lot of help from a lot of other people, this Scholarship of Learning, of Teaching and Learning initiative. And so it's been something that I've been personally interested in over the years. And so it's very, very exciting for me to see how it has grown. And under the leadership first of the director who established it, Samuel Thompson, and now under the very capable leadership of Jennifer Robinson.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Most people know you as Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculties. What do you oversee under those two hats?
Well, there are two parts to the office. The Dean of the Faculties part is the part that has to do with every aspect of faculty members' careers. From the moment the ad is placed in the Chronicle of Higher Education to solicit applications for a faculty position, our office is involved in through the interviews when the candidates come to campus to interview, through their orientation when they first come on campus their first semester, and throughout the whole of their career, through, of course, the promotion and tenure process, through support, through various awards and competitions of their research and teaching, and then even through their retirement and post-retirement, our office is involved with faculty members. And so I suppose you could say in some ways we're involved in the human resources piece as it affects faculty, but it's much more than that. We're also involved in the faculty intellectual life and the different career paths that faculty take across their whole time at Indiana University. And we really are involved in trying to support faculty so they can do their best work.
Now, does this cover all 8 campuses?
Or? No, this is just Bloomington. As Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculties, this is a Bloomington title. And the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs piece largely has to do with the oversight of the quality of undergraduate education. For example, the Lilly retention grants were secured by my predecessor, Deborah Freund, when she was Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, and were administered through my office. So that we're interested in faculty development in the area of teaching and ensuring the quality and consistency of programs across campus, and also providing instructional support and quality advising and all of the various things that impact on the undergraduate experience.
You spend most of your time then with faculty.
Yes, and it's a wonderful way to spend your time.
They can also be very highly independent people with different interests and agendas. How do you maintain collegiality among so many diverse thoughts?
Well, it's not a problem, because one of the best things about faculty is this independence and the incredible range of talents that are inherent in our faculty. We have so much intellectual and creative activity capital in the university. And the fact that faculty are independent is one of the best things about them, because they're self-starters. They are able to explore all different aspects of their research. And they do it all completely without much assistance from anyone else. Mm-hmm. But occasionally they'll need a little bit of help, perhaps, maybe some startup funds or some other support that needs to be given, perhaps. And that's when sometimes they come to our office. And it's a delight to be able to be involved in the academic enterprise with people who are doing fascinating, different, and exciting things.
One of your main assignments as dean of faculties involves tenure, and that's a hotly debated issue in academic circles. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that tenure is a wonderful thing. And, of course, we've just recently been celebrating Kinsey's work. Mm-hmm. And he's, of course, a perfect example of how tenure made it possible for him to move beyond his initial interests in gall wasps into a completely different area and to explore what was then a very controversial area of research. And Herman Wells, in his support of Kinsey, was able to explain how it is certainly appropriate for faculty members to investigate any area of knowledge, and that tenure gives a faculty member that kind of freedom. And Herman Wells, I think, understood that more than anyone else. And he said, unless faculty have that sort of freedom, you don't have a university, you have a trade school. If you want to be prescriptive, then run a trade school.
What do you say to the critics of tenure who argue that tenure gives the professor also the ability to sort of sit back and not work as hard?
Well, I suppose those people don't have any connection with Indiana University, because most of our faculty, whether they have tenure or not, work very hard. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, as you were mentioning earlier about the independence of faculty, the kind of people that become faculty are people who are driven by a passion for their research and their teaching, and who are, as I said earlier, self-starters. So that you don't usually have to worry about faculty not continuing to engage in their research and teaching with just as much passion at the end of their career as they did at the beginning. Their interests may change, mm-hmm. and they may emphasize research more at certain times in their career and teaching more at other times in their career. But what I think most faculty have in common is this continued passion for what they're doing.
You had just mentioned Herman B. Wells. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but his spirit is with us. Do you feel that still among the faculty?
I do. I think it's certainly very strong amongst those faculty who knew him personally or who had seen him at events and knew more about his life. I worry sometimes about how we're going to keep his presence as strong for people who joined the university since his death. But in many ways, I think that through our faculty orientation and our attempts, I think, to talk about the traditions and culture of the campus, both with students and with faculty, that we've done a fairly good job of reminding people about the importance to us of Herman Wells and of the traditions that he established. And I don't think that this will fade, because it's so much an integral part of our culture. But perhaps if we came back 100 years from now, no one will have heard of him. But I hope that's not the case.
So at this point, reading about Herman Wells is sort of a must-do assignment for anyone who wants to be on the faculty of Indiana University.
Well, I think it especially is so for people who are interviewing to be mm-hmm. administrators. I think that it's very interesting for them to understand the culture before they come to interview, very important for them to understand the culture. And one way of understanding the culture is to understand the part played by Herman.
How this university actually came about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because it's really, the university is better than it really has a right to be, given its location and its budget. And it's always valued the contributions of talented people.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Wells legacy. That's very central to the Wells legacy. And because we've always had exceptionally talented people and the university has valued those people, we have, I think, risen to heights that otherwise we wouldn't have attained.
Mm-hmm. Witness the School of Music, for example.
Yes. Look, who would ever believe you'd have a world-class school of music in the middle of the cornfields of Indiana? There are so many things. The auditorium, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Who would think that we would have a building like that was completed during the Depression? There are just so many things. The international programs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why would Indiana University in Southern Indiana have the strength in the international programs that we have? It's inconceivable if someone like Herman Wells hadn't had that vision.
Let's go back to you for just a moment. You're a vice chancellor, you're a dean, you're also a professor. How do you balance those three?
Well, it's not very hard because they're only titles. I have three titles, but actually most of my work is very integrated because I'm concerned with teaching and learning. I'm concerned with academic quality. And I'm concerned with trying to support the faculty because they're our most valuable resource. They're the heart of the university. The university is only as good as the faculty it can attract and retain. So that as a professor, I was concerned about those things. As a dean or a vice chancellor, it's just looking at the picture from a different perspective. I'm looking now across the campus. I'm seeing the whole landscape, whereas earlier in my career, I was looking at it within my department mm-hmm. and thinking about academic quality and how we could improve our teaching and learning opportunities for students and how our faculty could be improved and, mm-hmm. and supported. But I was looking at it as a professor in a department, in a small unit. Now I'm looking at the same questions and I'm committed to the same ideals, but I'm looking at the picture of the campus in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of research, research versus teaching is very often a hot-button topic for university administrators and faculty, of course. What do you tell the professor who says that his or her research abilities are hampered by teaching?
Well, you know, it's funny because no professor has ever said that to me, and I don't think anyone ever would, because people who choose the academic lifestyle and the faculty position are people who know that they're going to be involved in both. And when someone's passionate about their research, they want to share it with their graduate students mm-hmm. and with their undergraduates. So there really isn't as much of a difference between teaching and research as sometimes people outside the academy believe there is. And as I said, at different stages in people's career, they will often get excited about an area in their research that's different from an area they were working in previously. And that same thing happens with teaching. We get turned mm-hmm. on about different teaching problems at different times in our lives. And also this Scholarship of Teaching and Learning initiative, which we have, that we mentioned earlier, is a wonderful example of integration of the two, where faculty are encouraged to take their research skills that are disciplinary-based research skills and apply them to questions that have to do with teaching and learning. So that's a nice sort of bridging activity. And there's been a great deal of interest in doing this, in looking at trying to establish some evidence-based research about how we teach within our disciplinary framework and across campus. What are the things that we do, regardless of our discipline, that all faculty have in common? And what kinds of things are disciplinary specific when it comes to the way we approach teaching and learning?
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break here. We had mentioned the IU School of Music. As you know, we always ask the guests to provide music and to suggest music for our breaks. You suggested a performance by an IU faculty member, Kim Walker. Can you tell us a little bit about Kim?
Yes. Kim has been an associate dean in our office, and she has done a magnificent job of creating Arts Week for the last 2 years, has developed wonderful relationships with the city, and has had much more involvement with town and gown. And I think this last Arts Week, which has just been completed, was especially excellent.
And yes, it was.
It was very good. It involved a range of different kinds of artistic activities. And so I'm just delighted that Kim is associated with our office and that she's the person who is currently in charge of Arts Week. Of course, my dear friend Fran Snigg was the faculty member, and she was also in the Dean of Faculty's office at the time that Arts Week was created. And so we always remember Fran fondly when we talk about Arts Week. But I think she'd be pleased with the way her program has evolved and the way it's been nurtured by people like Kim Walker.
We'll get to Kim's playing in just a moment, but while we're on the topic of Arts Week, I think it's important to emphasize that this project is supposed to help to bridge the gap between town and gown.
Yes, and we're making such strides. Mayor Fernandez has been incredibly supportive of our efforts to work hand in hand with the city, and so have a lot of other people involved with the arts, connected with the city. And so we're especially happy about this, that this is something that we can work on collaboratively.
Coming up next, we have bassoonist Kim Walker. She's a member of the Indiana University School of Music faculty, and she's performing a piece by Bois Mortier. That was an excerpt from a sonata by French composer Joseph Baudin de Bois-Mortier. Kim Walker was the bassoon soloist, and this particular CD recording also includes performances by Klenna Stein and Daryl Nixon. We're talking to Dean Moya Andrews, Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculties at Indiana University. She's our guest today on Profiles. Moya, you were born in Australia, and you lived there well into your 20s. Can you tell us about that?
I did indeed. I am what Australians call a little girl from the bush. I grew up in a small town, Rockhampton, which is about 500 miles north of Brisbane. And Rockhampton is the beef center of Australia. So I spent a great deal of my early life interacting with cattle and horses and people whose livelihood revolved around the land and stations, what in America are called ranches. And so I had a childhood where I was in a subtropical area. Mm-hmm. I never had seen snow or ice. And this winter, of course, I've seen plenty of it. But before I was about 25, I had never seen any snow or ice because it was a very warm, tropical kind of lifestyle.
Do you miss Australia?
I do. I have been in this country, of course, now for longer than I lived in Australia. But I go home frequently, and there's a place in my heart, of course, that will always hold Australia close.
So your family is still there. You still have family members.
I have extended family members there, yes. My parents are both dead, but my sister and many, many other family members still live in that same part of central Queensland.
And the family was associated with ranching.
Right. So it was a very unusual thing for me to decide that I wanted to have a life of the mind or a university career. And I don't know where it came from. I don't know why I even pursued this dream, but I'm glad I did because it's been an interesting career.
How did you pick the topic or the field of speech and hearing sciences?
Well, actually, I was an elementary school teacher to start with. And in Australia at the time, you were assigned a school. You didn't apply for a job. The education department sent you to a school. And as part of my assignment, I was asked to work with children who had speech disorders. Mm-hmm. I was given 6 months training, and I became instantly a speech correctionist in the elementary schools. And I liked it so much that I decided that I needed to have some academic qualifications. And at that time, those weren't available in Australia. So I applied to enroll in the master's program in speech and hearing mm-hmm. at the University of California at Santa Barbara.
That was quite a change from Australia to Santa Barbara.
It was. When I saw Santa Barbara, I believed that everywhere in the United States was like Santa Barbara. I thought it was the most beautiful place in the world. That began a lifelong love affair that I've had with the United States. There was something about the energy and the can-do attitude that Americans seem to have mm-hmm. that really resonated with me. Though I did find when I moved to New York City that all of the United States is not exactly like Santa Barbara.
That must have been quite a change.
It was. It was a shock, a great shock to my system.
Among the many research interests that you list, one is voice disorders in children and adults. Can you talk a little bit about this specific area?
Yes. Of course, speech and hearing sciences encompasses problems, communication problems of many kinds. The kind that I have studied and that's been my chief research area has been problems associated with the throat, mm-hmm. with the voice, the way the voice sounds. So that it could be someone is born with a congenital problem of the throat or of the larynx or the vocal folds, or it could be that someone has an accident which causes them to have damaged vocal cords or throat problems of any kind, or there could be problems that are related to surgery or anything at all that causes a difficulty with someone producing voice. For instance, in adults, cancer of the larynx, which mm-hmm. which perhaps results in removal of the larynx altogether, and alternative methods of communication then have to be explored. So that it's quite a wide range of causes for disorders of voice. And in fact, one of the things that I have worked on since being at Indiana is the care of the professional voice, mm-hmm. because the Speech and Hearing Center is right next door to the School of Music. I learned about the particular problems that singers encounter when they have to perform under less than ideal circumstances. And in fact, one summer I had a research grant and spent the summer in Santa Fe studying the effect of altitude on singers because the Santa Fe Opera is, of course, an open-air opera. Mm-hmm. And the altitude is quite
rather high, yes.
So that was an interesting area. But the wonderful opportunity here to work with faculty and students in the School of Music, there are over 300 voice majors in the School of Music. Mm-hmm. And at any one time, many of them have colds or allergies or gastroesophageal reflux or other things that cause them to not have optimal voice quality. And so many of them would come to the Speech and Hearing Center, and I developed quite an interest in this and started a course, The Care of the Professional Voice, about 20 years ago. It was one of the first courses of its kind in the United States, but now that course is a very common course in universities and in speech and hearing programs. But I've always had this wonderful opportunity to be right next door to all of these singers. So I've learned a lot about singing and have collaborated a lot with faculty in the School of Music on research projects and have really developed quite an interest in the care of the professional voice. And that is an example of what I was mm-hmm. talking about earlier, how faculty members sometimes find new areas to interest them depending on circumstances at different times in their lives. And propinquity is important. Just because we were next door to the School of Music and a mm-hmm. lot of School of Music students came over to the speech clinic, I became interested in the whole mm-hmm. area of professional voice use.
You had mentioned the research that you had done at Santa Fe. I'm curious, what did come out of that? What effect does altitude have on a singer's performance?
A lot has to do with how much time they've had to adapt. The singer who flies in on the plane today and sings tomorrow is going to have a lot more problems, both breathing problems and problems with their vocal technique, than the singer who's been there a week mm-hmm. and has gradually adapted to the atmospheric conditions. Mainly it's things like dryness and mm-hmm. Mainly breathing. They had oxygen behind the stage at Santa Fe, and many of the singers would come off the stage and take oxygen.
Tell us briefly about the IU Speech and Hearing Department, where it excels and its achievements.
We're very proud of this department. It's consistently in the top 10 nationally for all of the programs. Mostly the speech pathology programs and the audiology programs are ranked about number 6 in the country. We have a very, very strong faculty and good facilities and a very good record of research, and we attract a number of grants. And so it's a very, very excellent program, highly regarded. Therefore, we attract good students, not only from Indiana, but from all over the United States. So it's been an exciting department. It's always been a very pleasant department to work in. I can't think of any other department that I know on campus that has consistently been so pleasant. People get on well, and it's always been a nice place to work. So I'm always glad when I get to go over to the speech and hearing department and be with my friends, some of them who've been here as long as I have, and that's since 1971. Mm-hmm.
We'll take a break here and listen to some music. And since we were talking about the human voice and singers in general, we have here a rendition of a Beethoven Lieder performed by Hermann Pry and also by Leonard Hokanson. We'll be listening to a selection from the 5 Lieder, Opus 82, by Beethoven.
Dimmi, ben mio, che m'ami, dimmi che mia tu sei. E non invidia ai dei la lor divinità, con un tuo sguardo solo, cara, con un sorriso, tu m'apri il paradiso di mia felicità, sì, di mia felicità. Come on.
That was Hoffnung from the 5-liter Opus 82 by Ludwig van Beethoven, performed here by Hermann Pry and by Leonard Hokanson. And it's a selection that was chosen by our guest, Dean Moya Andrews. She's Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculties at Indiana University, and she's also Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences. Moya, no interview is complete with you unless we touch on the topic of gardening. And in case you don't know about Moya and gardening, Moya's home is the one that's located right at the crossroads of Sheridan and Maxwell Lane. It sits kind of high on a bluff, and in the summer, it is a joy to behold. It's something that's not to be missed. Tell us about gardening and its role in your life.
Gardening is the thing that I enjoy most, I think, in the whole world. It seems to be central to my existence. Sometimes when I'm harassed or worried or upset about something, if I just go out in my garden for an hour, it puts everything in perspective. I think I started gardening because I love flowers so much. They're central to my happiness. It's as important to me as air and water to have flowers. And I realized that you never had enough flowers unless you grew them yourself. Mm-hmm. And that no one was ever going to give me enough flowers. Now, of course, with the wonderful flowers available at local stores, you can buy flowers right throughout all of the seasons. But my motivation when I started was so that I could always have flowers that I could pick and that I could share. And it's been a constant source of joy.
You know, when we prepared for this interview, one of the questions I asked you was whether you considered gardening to be an important part of your life because it provides closure, as it does for so many people. Gardening projects are something that you start and you can also have control over it and you can finish it. But you had a very interesting answer. You said that it was more like editing.
That's right. It's hard to edit out the things that have self-seeded. So much of what you plant ends up increasing, growing out of bounds. But it's yours, and you love it, and you want to wait for it to flower before you pull it out. But of course, if you do, then it will set seed, and then there'll be even more to pull out the next season. So I do really believe that gardening's like editing. You have to be ruthless about pulling out the things that aren't in the right place, just the way you have to prune mm-hmm. your sentences when you're writing an article or a book. It's very hard to eliminate some of your own words and to strike whole paragraphs that you labored over for a long time. And it's like that with gardening. I sometimes look at how the black-eyed Susans have spread and taken over so much of the bed, and I know I've got to rip them out, or I'll have a garden that is made up of only black-eyed Susans. But it's very hard to do because they're my black-eyed mm-hmm. Susans, and they're so cheerful and they're so wonderful, and the more you have them, the more you want to keep them. But it is very similar to editing. You have to say, does this flower really fit? Does this phrase really belong? Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, you have to have the courage to prune it out.
Tell us about your family.
I have a wonderfully supportive husband who is retired from the business school, so he understands about the faculty lifestyle and is a wonderful sounding board when I have problems, and always a wonderful support. I have a son who is the light of my life and a wonderful daughter-in-law who live close by. So I feel I'm very fortunate, since I only have one child, to have both my son and daughter-in-law happy to live in Bloomington so that I can see them frequently.
Mm-hmm. You seem to have found a way to combine professional life and family life. How do you do it? What's the secret?
Get a lot of help from your family. My husband does a lot of grocery shopping.
And gardening.
Yeah. Well, no, he's not so interested in the gardening. He writes a lot of checks related to the garden.
That's helpful.
But he enjoys the garden. But his hobby is stamp collecting, so he has a very different hobby. My family both overlook the fact that I'm often preoccupied and involved in projects that seem to go on and on. They, I suppose, are very understanding. I think that it's very challenging when your children are young to have a very demanding job as well as very demanding family life. Luckily, these things can be sequenced, as I said. Mm-hmm. I'm at the end of my career now, and my family is grown, and my husband is retired. And this provides me with a lot more flexibility. I could never have had an administrative job like this when I was in the earlier part of my mm-hmm. career, when I was working to get tenure, when my son was still young, when my husband was still involved in building his career. But a lot has to do with serendipity
mm-hmm.
and timing and whether or not other members of your family understand where you are at different points mm-hmm. in your evolution, both as a family member and as a faculty member.
You're an administrator, you're a teacher, you're a mother, a wife. You also publish a lot. When do you find the time for writing? Do you have to carve this time out judiciously to make sure that it happens?
Yes, of course. Like all faculty, you have to decide what is the best timetable for you, whether you take extra time in the summer or whether or not you work late at night. I've always been a late night person, mm-hmm. so most of my writing I do late at night or in the weekends. I get very little writing done, of course, during the week anymore. But I like to have some time for writing so that that part of my faculty self still finds expression.
Coming back to your administrative position, one of the comments that you've made about your office was, it must be in the hands of the faculty, not the administration.
That's been an IU Bloomington tradition that administrators, academic administrators, are faculty members first, and they may cycle in and do a stint as an administrator, as an academic administrator. But at their heart, they're faculty members. And we have a very strong faculty governance tradition on this campus. And we believe that faculty need to be involved in all the decisions that relate to their career development and to their life and work and conditions of work. And so when you have faculty administrators who are close to the faculty experience and part of the faculty experience, we believe that it creates a shared perspective. Administration then becomes part of the total collaborative activity that faculty are engaged in on this campus. So we think it's very important. Not all universities are as wedded to this as Bloomington is. The Bloomington campus has always liked the idea of having people whose first identity is as a faculty member mm-hmm. and who are secondarily serving a term as an administrator. We see this, of course, with chairs, department chairs. Many faculty members will serve a term, perhaps 3 to 5 years, as a chair, and then thankfully and with great relief get back into their lab or their studio or their office so they can continue with their real work. But by sharing the administrative duties in a department, it seems to create a more healthy, collegial kind of atmosphere where people understand what's involved in being chair and how much work mm-hmm. it is, because they've also served time perhaps in that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So we like this model of the other model you could go to would be have career administrators, people who worked as administrators across their whole career. But it's less appealing to people in Bloomington because the tendency exists for you to get out of touch with what it feels like to be in the classroom, what it's like to be in a faculty meeting, what faculty are thinking, and prevailing attitudes. So this model seems comfortable for the Bloomington academic community.
Mm-hmm. And it keeps you closer in touch with the students.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Because if you continue to teach, you're in touch with what the students are concerned about, what faculty are concerned about, and it helps. It helps you to see the landscape in a more detailed way you're seeing other people's perspectives as well as your own. I think perspective taking is one of the most important things for an administrator. If you can't imagine how it feels or seems to be in someone else's shoes, it's very hard for you to be able to relate to that person and to find out ways to help that person that will be the right ways for that other individual. Mm-hmm. I mean, I might decide that you would like some help that may not be at all what you had in mind. If I'm not able to consider varied perspectives and realize that other people see the world and, in fact, many things very differently from the way I do. Mm-hmm. And my clinical training, I think, has helped me with this. I think because I had always been a clinician and had always worked with patients, I have had training in being able to look at things from another person's perspective and understand that a problem isn't always solved by my solution. It's very good to give up that notion that my solution is not only the only solution that could work in solving this particular problem. So being a clinician taught me, I think, some very valuable lessons that have helped me as an administrator.
You're definitely not a top-down administrator.
Well, I don't think most administrators at IUB are. I think the culture here is very collaborative. Mm-hmm. It's a very teamwork-based culture. It's not hierarchical at all. Everyone here calls everyone else by their first name. That isn't the case at other universities. There are many universities where people are much more formal about titles. But here, there's an equality, there's a recognition that no matter what your role is, your contributions are really important. It's been a very valuable part of the Bloomington culture, and I think it's somewhat unique.
Earlier in the interview, we had mentioned some of the hot-button issues affecting higher education. We had talked about tenure. The other one was teaching versus research. What are some of the other issues that you see that are coming down the road that will be affecting higher education?
One of the things, of course, that's been in the news a lot is the increased hiring of non-tenure track faculty. And we have, of course, increased the number of faculty on our campus who are not tenure track or tenured. We haven't increase that number as much as many universities have, but there has been a steady increase. And I'm convinced that the reason for it, and it is a national trend, it's happening everywhere, the reason is the need for flexibility. Mm-hmm. You don't know where the enrollment bulge is going to move. In this decade, there may be lots of students wanting to go to the Kelly School of Business. But in the next decade, more students may want to enroll in the School of Education. If every one of your faculty positions is tenured or tenure track, you're locked in terms of the number of faculty that you have. So I think that the need for flexibility as enrollments change in various parts of the campus have made shorter-term contracts more attractive because also we have tight budgets, and the budget constraints are also a concern. But generally speaking, I don't think this trend to hire more faculty without tenure is driven by the economy as much as it is by the need for flexibility. There are certainly some economic reasons that we need mm-hmm. to be more flexible. I think that finding the balance between the number of tenured and tenure track faculty and the number of faculty who are on non-tenured lines is the real challenge in higher education today. And we need to do that in the context of our own academic institution. For example, with Bloomington as a Research One institution, we must always remember that the burden of keeping this a research institution rests on the tenure track and the tenured faculty, who are the research faculty. And so if the proportion of research faculty versus non-research faculty gets to the point where this burden is too great, we won't be able to maintain the research productivity mm-hmm. that we need to in order to maintain our Research 1 classification. So I'm concerned about that balance. Mm-hmm. I think that balance is really a very important concern and will continue to be mm-hmm. for the future. I also am worried about whether or not the tradition of service on the Bloomington campus can be maintained. It is difficult for young faculty when they first join to feel that they have time to do all of the research that they need to do to get their research program going, and also to prepare for their new courses and do an excellent job teaching, which they know is valued highly at Indiana, and also to feel that they have time to be involved in service activities, both in their unit and across campus. And yet I think, although we have to protect junior faculty from being overwhelmed with service responsibilities, I think that some service is very important for junior faculty because it's the way you learn about the institution. Mm-hmm. It's the way, by being on committees, campus committees, you meet colleagues from other units. And one of the real strengths of the Bloomington campus has always been this sense of community, the sense of knowing colleagues in other units, the sense of contributing to the overall mission of the university by working on campus-wide committees and learning about the university and how it works. And again, it's a question of balance. Everything in life seems to be a question of balance, mm-hmm. and it's always so hard for all of us to maintain a balance in our lives. But I think that balance between the teaching, research, and service is something that we need to be mindful of and not cut out the service component, because I don't think that it results in an enriching faculty experience. Mm-hmm. And also, if you don't become interested in service as a junior faculty member, it's likely that you will never develop an interest in service. So that if we protect junior faculty from any service activities at all, after they get tenure, they probably won't show much interest in contributing to the common good of the campus.
And of course, service is so important, especially in the younger faculty members, because this is such a huge university, it's very easy to get lost.
That's right. And making those connections has always been a very important concern of our office. We like to do activities where new faculty can meet each other, can form friendships. People of my generation will often say, "Oh, I know Professor X. He and I came the same year." And there's a bond because mm-hmm. they met when they were new junior faculty and they've known each other ever since. Well, this happened with me and George Walker and Trevor Brown. Many of the administrators that I work with now were young when I was young, or joined the faculty about the same time I did. And we grew up together on the faculty. We served on committees. We interacted with each other. And so now it's very easy for me to interact with them in their administrative roles because I've known them ever since we all joined the faculty in the 1970s. And these kinds of long-term collegial experiences are very precious, and they help the university, I think, to work well, and they help people to trust each other mm-hmm. across the university.
You've had an exceptional career as a professor, dean, vice chancellor. What legacy do you want to leave to Indiana University?
Oh, my, just the legacy that any faculty member leaves, that the doctoral students that I've trained and the other students that I've taught will pass on to their students and to the people that they work with some of the excitement and the passion for learning and teaching that is so much part of the academic community here at IU. Teaching our students to keep asking questions and developing better methods of inquiry so that we can learn more about how to treat people with communication disorders more effectively. because that whole area of communication is so central to mm-hmm. so many people's lives. I mean, your personal life, your professional life is impacted so significantly by your skill as a communicator, your ability to communicate your wants, your needs, so that hopefully the best legacy that anyone who's in the field of speech and hearing would hope for would be that the next generation will know more, do a better job for the people that need to be helped.
That was Dean Moya Andrews, Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences, Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, and Dean of the Faculties at Indiana University, Bloomington. Moya, we've come to the end, and it was a very fast hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was fun to talk with you, Christina.
And we learned a lot about your positions, about Indiana University, and about you. Thank you so much. Moya Andrews was our guest. This is Profiles on WFIU. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in March of 2003, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.